This message comes from Wall Street Journal sponsor C3 AI. C3 Generative AI equips enterprises with verified, traceable answers. It's secure, hallucination-free, LLM agnostic, and IP liability-free. Learn more at c3.ai. This is Enterprise AI.
A White House meeting on the debt ceiling fails to yield a breakthrough. Plus, former President Donald Trump is found liable for defamation and sexual abuse in a civil case brought by columnist E. Jean Carroll.
This just adds to the many legal woes that Trump has had as he's running for president. He also faces charges from the Manhattan DA's office, and there's several other investigations, including out of the Justice Department and a DA in Georgia.
And U.S. home prices are falling in nearly a third of the country. It's Tuesday, May 9th. I'm Anne-Marie Fertoli for The Wall Street Journal. This is the PM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories that moved the world today. President Biden, House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, and other congressional leaders have emerged from a high-level meeting at the White House on the debt ceiling without a breakthrough. It was the president's first substantial conversation with McCarthy about the debt ceiling since February, aimed at preventing a default. House Republicans want deep spending cuts in exchange for raising the borrowing limit. But Biden and congressional Democrats say the debt ceiling should be raised without preconditions. The federal government could default on its obligations as soon as June 1st if the debt ceiling isn't raised. That's something Democrats and Republicans say they want to avoid. But so far, neither side has presented a path forward that could pass both chambers of Congress. After leaving the meeting today, McCarthy said key leaders would meet again on Friday. Former President Donald Trump has been found liable to columnist E. Jean Carroll for battery and defamation, and he has been ordered to pay her $5 million in damages. After a two-week civil trial, a federal jury has concluded that Trump did not rape Carroll, but that more likely than not, he sexually abused her in a Manhattan department store in the 1990s. Trump has denied all wrongdoing and did not testify or appear in court in person. His lawyer played part of a videotaped deposition under oath where Trump accused Carroll of making up her allegations for publicity and political reasons. I'm joined now by Wall Street Journal court reporter Corinne Ramey. Corinne, can you start out by explaining this verdict for us?
Sure. So, as you know, this was a civil trial, not a criminal trial. So the standard for finding Trump liable for battery was lower than beyond a reasonable doubt. The jury had several options in finding Trump liable for battery. They could find that he raped Carroll, as she claimed in court, that he sexually abused her, or find that he committed forcible touching. And in this case, they didn't find that Trump raped Carroll, but they did find that he sexually abused her.
What does this mean for Donald Trump as he seeks re-election in 2024?
Trump has managed to deflect a lot of the legal challenges that have come his way. His supporters seem fairly unperturbed by the multiple investigations and even the criminal charges that he's now facing from the Manhattan DA. After those charges, his staff bragged about all the fundraising he had done and how it, in fact, the charges hadn't hurt him, but had in fact helped him. As you know, he's also facing investigations in Georgia from the Justice Department, and there's also a lawsuit with civil fraud investigations brought by the New York Attorney General that's supposed to go to trial later this year. So whether this particular finding in the civil case hurts Trump remains to be seen.
What have we heard from Trump in response to this verdict?
He posted on Truth Social just a few minutes ago. He said, "I have absolutely no idea who this woman is. This verdict is a disgrace, a continuation of the greatest witch hunt of all time," in all caps.
That's Wall Street Journal court reporter Corinne Ramey. New guidance from a government-backed panel of experts recommends women as young as 40 should get checked for breast cancer every 2 years. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force also recommends that women between the ages of 40 and 74 should get screened for cancer every other year. Our health reporter, Brianna Abbott, has more on the latest guidance.
There are a few different reasons that the task force has sort of made this change. Number one is that there is new evidence from a range of studies that sort of supports the benefit for lowering the age for women. And so they review the evidence every so often, and the evidence came out out more strongly in favor on that side. And then secondly, there's also been an increase in breast cancer incidence for women ages 40 to 49. And it was sort of increasing gradually since 2000. And then since 2015, it's been about a 2% increase every year. So it's really the combination of research that supports the new recommendation and also, you know, the increasing rate among younger women.
Breast cancer is the second leading cause of women's cancer death in the U.S., according to the American Cancer Society. The influential task force's new recommendation, which will be open for public comment through June 5th, could lead more doctors and patients to embrace mammograms starting at 40. Some doctors and medical organizations wanted the guidance to go further. Coming up, China has some competition when it comes to manufacturing capacity. Will India emerge as a key rival? More after the break.
This message comes from Wall Street Journal sponsor C3 AI. Insights. You need them to solve business problems, but buried in volumes of disparate data, they're seemingly invisible. C3 Generative AI enables business leaders to instantly access secure, hallucination-free, verifiable insights from a unified knowledge source, all with a natural language search. Turn the invisible into the obvious with C3 Generative AI. Learn more at c3.ai.
Western companies are looking for a backup to China's manufacturing might, and India is emerging as a key rival despite internal supply chain challenges. It's a strategy known as China Plus One. But can India make its case and be the plus one, overcoming its own challenges? Joining me now to talk more about this is our chief economics commentator, Greg Ibb. Greg, tell us a bit more about India and why it's emerged recently as a potential plus one here.
India's emergence is really the mirror image of what's going on with China. China is and has been for a while the world's factory floor. They tower above everybody else in terms of manufacturing output. But a lot of Western companies that do business in China have had reason to rethink that for a number of reasons. It's gotten to be a more expensive place to do business because wages have gone up. They've never been comfortable with the extent to which the government there forces them to share their technology with Chinese competitors. And in the last year or two, you've seen this big push by Western governments to decouple their economies from China's because they're just wary of being too close economically to an adversary. So you've got all these companies that now are looking for another place with low-cost wages to do their manufacturing. And so India seems to be a natural place to look. And indeed, it might be emerging as the favorite of the so-called China plus one strategy, China plus another location. India, to a lot of folks, seems like the logical place to go for a backup.
What can you tell us about the manufacturing capacity in India right now and some potential challenges that businesses wanting to move there could encounter?
Well, India has clearly established a good foothold in this area, especially in electronics. There's been a lot of attention to the fact that Apple, which has been making iPhones in India since 2017, recently signaled it was expanding significantly its presence in the country. It began assembling its most recent version of the iPhone just within months of its release in India. It's estimated that in a few years, India could account for as much as a quarter of Apple's iPhone production globally. And importantly, it's not just Apple, but Apple is having its suppliers move to India. Companies like Foxconn Technology Group, which is based in Taiwan and is the main assembler of Apple products. And renewable energy is one that a lot of people find very exciting. The government has pushed to vastly expand India's renewable energy capacity. So Vestas, which is a Danish company, one of the world's largest producers of windmill turbines, a few years ago, they decided to significantly expand their presence in India, building the turbines, the windmill blades, and so forth. And they told us that this was explicitly intended to reduce their dependence on China, which up until recently had been their main regional production center in Asia. And another factor is, quite frankly, that China's government has essentially pursued a policy of ensuring that Chinese companies, not Western companies, get the benefits of China's rollout of renewable energy. So it's frankly quite difficult for a Western company to set up shop in China and expect to actually benefit much from the Chinese market. Today, at least, companies still see the Indian market as more open to them than the Chinese market, and therefore they're willing to make that presence felt.
Are there other countries that are competing for this plus one status, and is there enough to set India apart?
There's a lot of countries that want to be the plus one. Just to name a few obvious examples, Vietnam is a country that's received a lot of investment and a lot of attention in the last few years, and their exports have grown even more rapidly than India's. Mexico obviously has a lot of benefits going for it, its proximity to the United States and its membership in the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Free Trade Agreement, a lot of low-cost labor. Bangladesh, actually, right next to India, a country that has done extremely well, for example, in textiles and clothing, and it's considered relatively business-friendly. Malaysia, Thailand, Indonesia, all these countries have some sort of purchase on the possibility of being the next China, so to speak. The place you're likely to end up, I think, is that no single country will be the next China. It will be a range of countries. And in this contest to be the preferred alternative, India has to recognize that there's a lot of competition and that they have a lot of obstacles to overcome. It's still a place where the bureaucracy is very burdensome and slow. In China, one of the things that attracted companies there is that the labor force is easy to access, and you have tens of millions of workers willing to uproot and move hundreds of miles to a factory job. And in India, culturally, that's just not something that happens as often. I think the final point I'd like to make is that China, at least early on, committed to a sort of a quasi-free trade model where they dropped tariffs very low for companies that wanted to import components for products that they then planned to export. That is not what India has done. India has actually raised its external tariffs. And to balance that out, they've offered incentives to companies that produce in India for export. So at one level, I think even though India's government wants to be part of global supply chains, they aren't yet at the point of fully committing to the policies that are necessary to make that happen.
That's Wall Street Journal chief economics commentator Greg Ip. Greg, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
U.S. home prices are falling more than they have in over a decade. The National Association of Realtors says nearly a third of metro areas have posted annual price declines during the first quarter of the year. Here now to discuss the state of the housing market is Wall Street Journal housing reporter Nicole Friedman. So, Nicole, not too long ago we were talking about the split between or tale of two housing markets. What are we seeing now generally sort of across the country?
Yeah, so the tale of two housing markets is definitely still in play. We have really a divide kind of split right down the center of the country. So it's really those western markets, West Coast and Mountain West markets that are seeing stronger price declines. Places like San Francisco, Austin, Texas, Boise, Idaho, Reno, Nevada, San Jose, all these markets are posting more significant price declines. And in a lot of other parts of the country, in the Southeast, the Midwest, prices are still rising year over year in these markets. And so it's really a divide between places where prices rose the most during the pandemic or places that were already quite expensive. More unaffordable markets are seeing bigger price declines, and the more affordable markets are still seeing price increases.
What are the expectations you're hearing about the next couple of months?
So it's really an interesting housing market right now. There's kind of this battle going on between affordability on the one hand, which is making demand lower, buyers are unable to qualify in some cases. But then we have limited supply on the other hand, and that is keeping prices maybe from falling more or in some places keeping prices rising. The fact that a lot of homeowners have low mortgage rates already, they have mortgage rates at 3%, 3.5%, they don't want to sell. They don't want to give up their current homes and their current low rates to go buy another home at a 6.5% mortgage rate. And so the supply is still really low, even as demand is low, which is kind of keeping the market in a more uncertain position going forward.
That's Wall Street Journal housing reporter Nicole Friedman. Now to some retail news. City retailers are having a tougher time attracting foot traffic, with fewer people commuting into the office 5 days a week. Pedestrian foot traffic in U.S. urban downtowns was down about 25% in April, compared with the same month in 2019, according to real estate software provider MRI Springboard. But downtown's loss has been the suburbs' gain. Landlords in the suburbs say demand from retailers has been strong despite high inflation and rising interest rates. Restaurant chains like Sweetgreen have expanded into the suburbs, and even malls, long challenged by online retail, are starting to see a boost. Simon Property Group says foot traffic at its malls is higher this year than it was in 2022, and that overall occupancy is about 94.4%, close to pre-pandemic levels. Ryanair has agreed to buy up to 300 more of Boeing's 737 MAX 10 aircraft. Under current list prices, the deal has a potential value of $40 billion. Ryanair will buy 150 airplanes with the option to buy up to another 150. The deal marks a turnaround in the relationship between Boeing and one of its biggest customers. A year ago, Ryanair chief executive Michael O'Leary had publicly criticized the manufacturer's commercial jet arm over delays in delivering aircraft. The arrest of former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan on corruption charges earlier today has sparked protests within the country. Demonstrators clashed with police and blocked roads, leading to dozens of arrests. The former prime minister was ousted from office just over a year ago after he lost both military support and a no-confidence vote in parliament. His arrest today threatens to worsen economic and political turmoil in a country already reeling from floods, terrorism, and the threat of bankruptcy. A spokesman for Khan's party described the arrest as the law of the jungle and said the party is worried for Khan's life. Pakistan's government says Khan was arrested by an independent law enforcement body that tackles corruption. And finally, as we've been reporting, tech companies like Amazon, Microsoft, Salesforce, Meta, and IBM have been cutting jobs, with tens of thousands of people laid off so far this year. That's according to data tracker layoffs.fyi. So if you hear that your job may be on the line, what can you do to prepare for and land your next gig? At the Wall Street Journal's Job Summit, LinkedIn career expert Catherine Fisher said you should start by processing what you've gone through.
It's really important to allow yourself that time, you know, to grieve, right? Like, this is a very stressful time. A lot of our identities are wrapped up in our jobs, your livelihood, and that is absolutely understandable.
And Fisher said once you're ready, it's time to make a plan for finding a new job. And you should approach that with some discipline.
Make really specific goals. And then, so that is like the networking part of it. The next part of it is taking a look at your skills, matching that with the roles that are of interest to you, seeing where is there an imbalance? What skills do you need to acquire that you don't have to get that next job and start learning?
You can hear more of Catherine's advice on how to get through a layoff and find your next job on our sister podcast, As We Work. And that's what's news for this Tuesday afternoon. We'll be back tomorrow morning. I'm Anne-Marie Fertoli for The Wall Street Journal.
This message comes from Wall Street Journal sponsor C3 AI. C3 Generative AI equips enterprises with verified, traceable answers. It's secure, hallucination-free, LLM agnostic, and IP liability-free. Learn more at c3.ai. This is Enterprise AI.